All right, so we have our first presenter, Kitty Ewing. I think I said it right. The benefits of technology in medical coding. Are you ready?
Yeah, kind of. I don't know how to share my screen though.
Oh, okay. In the Teams screen, if you go by, there's a share screen. There's a square above with the up arrow and it says share. And if you have any audio on your presentation, then you need to also say okay to computer audio. I hope that helped.
Maybe. I don't know if you guys can see my screen.
Not yet. If you click on that share, it will ask you how you want to share. So you could say entire screen and then click on entire screen and then it should bring it up. Sounds good. Oh, we saw your desktop. So yes, there you go.
All right.
Perfect.
I'm going to tell you about the benefits of technology in medical coding. We're going to talk about medical coding before, which was paperwork, medical coding now, the electronic, the medical billing will be explained. Then was paper and now is electronics, digital technology and healthcare, AI and coding, seven key benefits of technology, and then the conclusion. Medical coding, what is it? It is the process of taking patients' diagnostic and treatment notes and converting them into correct alphanumeric codes for accurate billing and record keeping. For instance, if you go in for abdominal cryological findings in specimens, the code would be R87.62. If you put any other code, it could mean any other numbers or letters. It could be anything else. If you add a zero to it, it'll become atypical, squeamish cell of undetermined significance in cryptological smear. Just one digit changes it all. The different types of coding are the current procedural codes, also known as CPT, healthcare common procedure coding system, the HCPCS, also known as HCPCS. Then there's the International Classification of Disease and the 10th Revision Procedure Coding System, also known as ICD-10 PCS, and then the Clinical Modifications ICD-10 CM. You have to use all these different codings when coding medical terminology. One is for procedures, what they're being used for. The other one tells you the procedure was for, and it's a whole lot of extra work. Medical coding way back when was paperwork. Paperwork was done manually. You had to flip through the books, every single one, search down every term, and that took hours and hours to do. Paperwork increased if the insurance company denied payments or procedures due to coding errors or billing errors, which happened quite frequently because people would accidentally push a wrong button and not, I mean, put a wrong, write a wrong number, and the insurance companies would deny claims quickly because of the small, just a tiny little error. It was time consuming manually going through the books. It wasn't until the 2000s when things went digital. Medical coding now is electronic. Now medical coding and billing has improved greatly because they have software referred to as an encoder. They can use to easily find the proper codes to use with fewer denied claims. The software flags improper coding that suggests to the coder an alternative one to use. Software as the EMR, CodeLink Online, or MediCore. AI and coding. How does AI impact coding? Machine learning algorithms can analyze large amounts of medical data. It pulls the medical terminology out of the medical files and translates it for you, so you don't have to spend the hours looking through the books. It assists in accurate coding. It flags potential errors and inconsistency, enhances accuracy, reduces billing discrepancies, improve the efficiency of revenue cycle management. Medical billing. What is medical billing? It's the process after all the coding is complete. The process of generating correct patient claims or invoices based on the coding and sending it to the insurance companies for payment. Insurance companies will approve or deny claims based on the codes being used. The billing process begins as soon as you set up your doctor's appointment. Medical billing then was all the same as the medical coding. Paper, paper, and more paper. More opportunities for clerical errors due to paper records, incorrect medical codes for billing, and manual submissions of bills via mail or fax. So it took longer for claims to be approved or denied. Medical billing now. The benefits of technology in medical billing are lowered cost and reduced revenue cycle times between patient care and payments. There is efficiency and time saving, accuracy in coding, electronic claim submissions, improved revenue cycle management, error reduction, enhanced data security, and real-time eligibility verification. Digital technology and healthcare. Pros in digital technology, data collections, research, medical billing and coding, remote monitoring, compliance with healthcare regulations, and a timely diagnosis and treatment. Biggest advantage is saving time, reducing paperwork, removing any errors that can affect the entire medical process. The cons are, I didn't get that far to write it down, but the cons are if you put in wrong codes, it's still time consuming because you have to bill back and forth emails and everything with the other people. It's still time consuming, but not as much. And the conclusion is the impact of modern technology on medical billing and coding is clear. On medical billing and coding has proven its benefits and will continue to do so. through automation, accurate coding, and compliance tools. Technology has streamlined and improved these critical processes. Outsourcing medical billing to specialized service providers leverages an advanced technology expertise, leading to enhanced revenue cycle management, reduced costs, and improved operational efficiency. As technology continues to advance, the futures of medical billing and coding holds great potential for further optimization with the integration of AI and adaptations to support telehealth services.
Nice presentation, Tabitha. Anybody have questions for her? Yeah, it's a coding is not very easy to do. I thought about doing that one time, but I ended up doing medical transcription. Now, that was impossible for me because the doctors that were talking were mumbling half the time. I didn't know what they were saying, and I just gave up. Couldn't do it.
It's tedious. I don't like it either. I'm actually, after I graduate in 2 more weeks, I'm going to go become an EMT instead.
Ah. I understand that. Yeah.
I like more hands-on. Sitting in front of a computer is not my thing.
Yeah. Well, you find that out pretty fast after you get involved in it, going, maybe this is not what I want to do.
Well, yeah. I have 2 little kids, too, so it's hard to be on a computer around them.
Oh, yes, definitely, because they want your attention. Mom.
Yep.
I know how it is. Well, I don't. Because I'm not a mother, but I have a dog. She does the same thing. So she wants my attention when I'm doing my meeting. So she's outside right now.
Mine are right. Upstairs.
Yeah, got it. So if there's no other questions for Tabitha, we have our next speaker tonight. Is it Foley? I'm not sure if I'm seeing it right. I'm so sorry. Tools and sites to develop programming skills.
Hi.
Maybe you can let me know. Yeah. How do you pronounce your name? I'm sorry.
So the PH make a F sound. So it's like F-O-E, like enemy. So just foe.
Oh, like foe. Oh, yeah. Okay. Oh, okay. I wasn't sure and I took a guess. I'm so sorry. But go ahead, you have the floor.
Yeah, of course. Let me just, how do I present again?
You would, in the Teams screen, there's a box that has an up arrow and it says share. Yes, there you go.
All right, do you guys see it?
Yes.
All right, I do apologize. I do have a wide screen, so it might be small for some people. All right. Anyway, so yeah, my topic is about tools and sites to develop programming skills. And this topic is just to help people improve their programming skill, whether they are somebody new to programming or somebody that been in the programming or technology world for a while. So yeah, the presentation goal is informing new and experienced programmer how to achieve their programming skill. And then discuss ethical usage of AI tools in programming. Some of the topic I will be discussing today are website to help develop programming skills, way to practice those skills, some IDE recommendation, and AI tools to help in development. All right, so starting off, these are some websites that is for entry level. And if you are new to programming, I would always highly recommend Khan Academy, because it's a great fundamental space for you to learn programming. And it teaches you more on how computer communicate with each other rather than actual programming language. It does has a Python course in it. And it also does provide extra resources like to other website after you're done learning from Khan Academy. And then after that, if you are going to be a casual learner, I would recommend Udemy, just because this is a site not only focused on programming skill, but can be something from photography to marketing, just any useful life skills. And this does allow you to just learn at your own pace throughout whenever you want. And then lastly, I would recommend the Coursera. I'm not sure if I'm saying that right, but this is a great place to take courses and also find a new career. In fact, it's more of like a search engine that allows you to find a degree or certificate. All right. With that being said, if you are gonna be like, once you start learning the fundamental and want to learn more specific programming language, this is gonna be the slide which. All right, so the first one is web development. If you are wanting to get into web development, I recommend the Odin project. It will give you like the foundation of web development, a course that you can take by yourself, and it is open source, so it is free. It gives you the ability to learn CSS, HTML, JavaScript, and Ruby. Second, I would recommend Code Academy for any other languages and including AI. Code Academy, you do have to pay for it. I'm not too sure if there's a student feature, but you should look into that if you want to go to Code Academy. And it also provide future career path plus certificates. And then the third one would be coding for coding syntax. Once you learn coding, once you learn a programming language, you might need to refresh your memory and stuff like that. So W3 is a great place to not only find how to code, but like look at the syntax, exercise, and certificates can be obtained from there as well. And then lastly, once you experience and you are like far beyond the beginner coding I guess experience, you might want to try Udacity. It is quite expensive, but this is for like advanced programmer, and it is to learn real world IT career such as cloud computing, business and analytics, data science, and et cetera. And these are some notable websites that I didn't really get into detail, which you can still use. So Scrimba is a subscription-based web development and AI learning tool. EDX is a great place to find degree certificate and a place to also find a coding boot camp, which not a lot of the other site would be sent. SoloLearn is a $6 per month subscription for web development, Java, Python. And the unique part about this one is it's like a Duolingo-like environment. Allison is a great place for gaining certificate and free courses. And Osu is a type of, it's a open source society university developed from GitHub. And it's more like a diamond in the rough just because it's allow you to complete like a 3-year courses for free inside GitHub. Anyway, this is all the website I listed based on the price, what you can learn from them, and the unique benefit. I'm just gonna leave this up for like 7 more seconds if anybody want to take a screenshot. Alrighty. So once you start learning all these programming skills, there are some way that you want to practice. So this slide will be going over the gamified way. So it's more generally as an entertainment and a way to practice code. And I just want to say not all of these are kind of meant for anybody in this presentation. Like starting off, the first one's Code Monkey. It's for people age 5 and 14. It's a great place for kids to start learning programming. So if you guys have kids that are around that age, that's a great place to start. Similarly, for code.org, it's a place for middle school and high schooler to get online courses material. And any educator can also use this place to find material for the students. But lastly, a little bit more advanced, in general, anybody can use this. It's CodeWar. It's an interactive learning environment, and it's great for learning syntaxes which support a variety of supported language. So it ranges from Python, Java, JavaScript to R language. To there was a lot more listed. So while those are the gamified version, this is the one that I truly recommend. First is LeetCode. LeetCode is great for coding for an interview. And the more you practice in LeetCode, the more comfortable you will be in your programming skill. While everything in LeetCode is free, if you want to get the premium version, it does contain cloud storage, video solution, and a debugger, which none of them are needed for you to actually practice your code. They are just like premium status for you and just nice little tool for you to have. Lastly, LeetCode has a lot of challenges. So if you don't are confused or overwhelmed by those, you can try the website neetcode.io, which lists or like have it provide a curated list for LeetCode from easy to hard. And then my second recommendation is try Hackbee, and everybody from the cyber department team, cybersecurity department team already are aware of this. It's a great personalized hackable place for you to learn just cybersecurity tools and stuff. It provides module learning path and networking towards other careers in cybersecurity. And then next slide will be talking about some IDE. The first IDE I wanted to talk about is anything from JetBrains products such as PyCharm, WebStorm, RubyMine, and IntelliJ. These are all great, powerful IDE, which allows you to compute their specific language in a like strong environment and just allows a lot of personalization for that computer language. The second IDE I will recommend is the Visual Studio Code. It allows you to have multiple IDE just in one software. So if you want, like if you're not trying to install multiple programs into your computer, this is probably the one that you should get. And then some other notable IDE is Eclipse Visual Studio, which not to be confused with Visual Studio Code, and NetBrains from Apache. All right. And for the final few slides, I will be talking about some AIs, tools that can help you in programming. And these are like just some concern when using AI with programming. First is that AI might hinder the ability for you to think critically. So when using AI, you don't really want to ask them how to program your whole program. So for example, if you're making a blackjack game, you wouldn't ask the AI to create the whole blackjack game for yourself, because this will just instantly create a whole game. And in a sense, like you won't be learning anything. A good practice is like to make AI or like ask AI simple questions that you get stuck on, such as if you want to make a deck like in Python or something. This way you can learn how to make the deck, but also still work on the program. Finally, AI isn't a tool that you should fear. It is something that exists and is definitely something of the future. So AI is like something, it's like your partner. So you have to use it eventually, especially in the technology world that we are in. And it's just the way you use it is how it will affect you. All right, so the first AI I'm going over is Google Gemini. And Google Gemini is a new AI, it's a powerful AI. Its purpose is to understand text, images, audio, and video. Some of the benefit is that it's able to be able, like use as a Q&A, as a visualizer. And it is also integrated into other Google products like Google Docs, PowerPoints. Google AI P premium is $20 per month if anybody want to try Google Gemini. The second AI I want to go over is Microsoft Copilot. And similarly to Google Gemini, this is an integrated AI, but it works with Microsoft app. And the neat thing about this one is some of like this AI is already installed in some people's computer, but it also exists as a sidebar. So while you are opening something, you can just click on it and then it will appear on the side. To obtain this, you can easily log into your Microsoft account and download it. And finally, the last AI I wanted to talk about is GitHub Copilot. And this one is really unique as it is dedicated for programmer. It increases productivity and efficiency because it allows real-time suggestion. It also allows you to chat with the bot in the IDE. But yeah, so the best way to obtain this, well, first you can pay $10 per month to get it, or you can get it through your Purdue Global email. So what you do is you go to GitHub, you sign up, you put your Purdue Global email, and before they allow you to get it, you need to do a F2A. You need to put in your billing address, and you need to have a proof of confirmation that you are a student. The proof of confirmation for what I used was just some of my documents I had for my billing in Purdue. And that's about it. These are some of the references I have. All right. Any question, comment, and concern?
Good job.
Thank you.
Very thought out.
Hey, I had one question, if you don't mind.
Yes.
I just had a question on what do you think is the best programming language to start with? Because I personally know C sharp, but I think I've heard that Python is probably the easiest to start with.
Okay. Throughout my research, I did found that there was two main languages that is used throughout the world. Like the biggest one, first is JavaScript, and the second is Python. So any like maybe a web, and it really depends on what you're trying to do. Are you trying to learn web development? Are you trying to learn like some other skill? But generally, Python is a great one just because it can be universal in any single skills that you might come across.
Okay. Yeah, I was just curious. That was the only question that I had.
All right, thank you. All right.
Any other questions?
Then I'm going to mute myself and shout out to Kyle for telling me some of the AI tools for my project.
No worries, man. Glad it worked out.
Cool. Yes. It's when you have someone to collaborate and help. But questions. I've done it. No wrong, nothing wrong with that. Okay. We have another speaker. Trevor, ethics and authenticity using AI as a tool. Are you ready?
Yep. Yep. Can you hear me?
Yes.
This will be a good transition, I feel like, with the previous presentation. All right, I'm sharing my screen. Can you see it?
Yes.
All right. So tonight I'll be discussing the intelligence and ethical considerations necessary in working with artificial intelligence. In this presentation, we'll briefly investigate the following concerns and principles involved with artificial intelligence and many of the overseeing problems in developing and utilizing this technology. Artificial intelligence is the field of computer science dedicated to creating machines capable of performing tasks that typically require human intelligence. This broad definition encompasses various aspects, including machine learning, reasoning, and problem solving. The concept of artificial intelligence traces back to the 1950s with Alan Turing's Computing Machinery and Intelligence, which introduced the Turing test, demonstrating machines' ability to exhibit human-like intelligence. John McCarthy went on to further develop this concept in his work coining the term artificial intelligence in 1956. Over time, technological advancements have led to the exponential growth in machine capabilities and computing power. This progress has given rise to various AI tools and technologies, including large language models like the ones previously mentioned, and like ChatGPT, Copilot, all that stuff, and advanced data analytics as well, which are widely utilized. With these advancements, there's a growing discourse surrounding the ethical and social implications of artificial intelligence. The rapid advancement and widespread application have raised significant ethical concerns, which encompass various aspects, including the uses of AI, privacy and security, large corporations controlling access, bias mitigation, data protection, and ethical training of AI systems. As artificial intelligence becomes more prevalent, there are concerns about how technology may affect an individual's rights, freedoms, and opportunities. The dominance of large corporations in the development and deployment of AI raises concerns about access and control. With powerful computing capabilities required for development, smaller entities and individuals may be at a disadvantage, leading to concerns about the concentration of power and influence in the hands of few corporations. Transparency and accountability in the use and governance of AI systems are crucial to ensure ethical practices and prevent potential misuse of these technologies. Bias mitigation is another significant ethical concern in development. Systems trained on bias and or incomplete data sets may perpetuate or amplify existential societal biases, leading to unfair or discriminatory outcomes. Addressing bias requires careful attention to data set selection, algorithm design, and ongoing monitoring to identify and mitigate biases. The public discourse surrounding the filtering of content generated by AI models highlights the ethical considerations related to the spread of certain information. There are debates about what content should be filtered out to prevent the spread of harmful or misleading information, balancing considerations of free speech with the need to prevent harm. Ethical AI development involves considering the potential impacts of AI-generated content and implementing mechanisms to identify and address harmful or inappropriate content. Additionally, the monitoring of human behavior using AI raises concerns about individual privacy and security. AI systems capable of analyzing and interpreting human behavior may intrude upon individuals' privacy rights and reshape societal norms around surveillance and consent. Ethical considerations include ensuring transparency, informed consent, and safeguards against misuse or abuse of personal data collected through AI monitoring systems. Addressing these ethical concerns requires collaboration among stakeholders, including researchers, developers, policymakers, and civil organizations. Here I just have a video that kind of elaborates on the ethics of artificial intelligence. This video was created by the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization. Let me know if you guys can hear it.
Do you use any navigation application to go through traffic jams? What happens when you scroll down through your social media feed? Do you follow any recommendation that any streaming service might give you? So by the end of the day, we know that AI is there, but do we actually understand what is going on? And can we trust the output of those applications?
To date, the approach that we've taken to these kinds of technologies is to say, well, consumers can figure this out on their own. They can read the terms and conditions on websites. They can choose not to participate in certain digital environments.
Trevor, can you mute your mic, please?
Some platforms are part of our lives. They are part of the way that we provide education. They are part of the way that we look for jobs. And that power imbalance cannot be addressed by simply giving consumers more information or giving them individual rights of complaint. What we're ultimately going to have to do, if we're going to change the kind of structural ways in which these technologies are designed, is to push the responsibilities back on our designers, back on the organizations who are relying on technologies to change their practices.
Technologies like artificial intelligence have the potential to empower people and to broaden their perspectives, or they can widen inequalities and really don't contribute to address our societal challenges. But we cannot blame the technologies. It's not about the technologies. It's about us developing the framework, shaping the rules that will allow these technologies to deliver to what we want them to achieve. And we need to make sure that we embed those very important ethical principles, the protection and promotion of human rights and human dignity, that would at the end determine the outcomes.
Responsible governance of AI technologies without the buy-in of big tech and other companies is impossible. It is necessary for us to find ways in which to explain to them that ethics is not about abstract principles. Ethics should be bottom up. It is a dynamic system. It should enable innovation and in the end lead to trust in products of these companies, which would lead to success in terms of whatever their business aims are.
We see how ethical debates end up playing an important role in shaping the conversation of AI regulation. Over the last 5 years, we saw a plethora of charters, declaration of AI ethical principles. We are seeing right now that those principles are being applied on a very practical basis. A lot of countries in Latin America have already come up with their national strategies on artificial intelligence, but some countries in the region are going a step further. They are actually regulating through hard law some of the principles of artificial intelligence.
In the European Union, we're looking at draft AI acts. In the US, Congress is starting to talk in great detail about monopoly power of technology companies. And you can see the wheels turning across the world as countries move from awareness raising to strategy to attempts at implementation, attempts at regulation.
Lack of accessibility to these technologies, by definition, would exclude one from the debate on responsible governance, because in effect, the decisions that are generated in such a process would just not apply to a person who was not part of the data set. So in fact, you are deleted. You don't exist. What is linked to this as well is the issue that previously colonized countries are excluded from conversations around what responsible governance would be, and this just exacerbates the problem.
So there is a first step that needs to be taken, which is to understand which groups are excluded from this conversation. Because when we talk about regulation of AI, we're talking about privacy, we're talking about that protection, we're talking about freedom of expression, we're talking about very basic human rights.
What makes the difference is to have sound regulatory frameworks that will protect privacy, that will enhance transparency, that will really deliver on accountability. But this is something we need to shape. It needs to be through a process where we listen to everybody. And I feel that this is the only way we can deliver strong basis for the technologies to deliver to our human goals.
The great risk at this point in time is that artificial intelligence becomes an arms race in which each country only focuses on its own context and see the other countries as competitors. AI might build bridges and connect people and countries, but at the same time, could be the other way around. This is the debate that you should care about, because that's the debate that is shaping up our future with technology.
All right, sorry about that. Did my mic cause some issues with the sound?
It was just echoing.
Oh, okay.
And I didn't realize that too, because then I would have to do that later myself, but go on.
All right. So privacy concerns. Significant concerns revolve around how models are trained and their handling of potentially sensitive human information. This includes behavioral data such as tracking individuals' physical locations or their usage patterns across applications and websites. While these concerns have historically been present with the use of the internet and other technologies, they are particularly relevant in the context of artificial intelligence due to questions about models' understanding of sensitive information and their protocols for sharing it. Large language models capture all inputs with the aim of enhancing the application's performance. Users must be cognizant of this when engaging with such tools. The Cambridge Analytica scandal stands as an example of how AI can be leveraged to impact political functions. The scandal involved harvesting personal data from the social network site formerly known as Facebook to draw inferences about individuals utilizing that information to influence both the 2016 US presidential election and the Brexit campaign. This scandal drew extensive backlash for the companies involved, leading to significant financial and legal repercussions and severe public distrust. The New York Times has published an article detailing the context of the scandal and the scrutiny faced by both parties upon the public release of information through a whistleblower. Addressing these ethical concerns in AI development requires extensive measures to safeguard sensitive information, including transparent data collection and usage policies, privacy protections, and mechanisms for accountability and oversight. Developers and organizations must prioritize ethical considerations and adhere to ethical guidelines to ensure responsible deployment of AI technologies. Recent developments showcase AI's ability to produce sophisticated images and speech excerpts, showcasing the potential for creation of misinformation as well as deepfakes. A deepfake is the manipulation of image or speech to produce fake content that may lead an audience to believe someone said or did something they did not actually do. There is currently no law against the production or use of deepfakes, which can potentially be utilized in defamation of public figures or really any individual. Today, we can see evidence of deepfakes embedded in social media websites such as TikTok, X, and Meta, and must be considered for legal reform in order to prevent the spreading of misinformation. These actions are a serious detriment to society, and further legislation is required in order to prevent this unethical misuse of artificial intelligence. In order to prevent the unethical use of artificial intelligence, it is important we establish principles in developing these tools to ensure they are operating ethically. This can be accomplished through putting in place foundational policies in the architecture of AI. By establishing and maintaining governance, we can successfully implement ethical considerations to eliminate the potential for misuse. With remarkable AI applications developed, such as ChatGPT and DALL-E, many concerns have risen in the authenticity of art and original ideas. There are several threats posed with utilizing artificial intelligence in assistance to the creation of art, such as poetry, film, and other creative forms of expression. With the foundation of AI mirroring human intelligence, many questions arise on the originality of these works. There are additionally growing concerns with artificial intelligence and its use in academia, providing students with content that may not be credible. If the content is, however, credible, another challenge arises for how the credit is sourced or cited as a source. With lack of credible sources provided, the assistance of generative AI is considered plagiarism in nature. These uses of artificial intelligence showcase the ethical concerns that must be considered for the future society of how we view authenticity. Although artificial intelligence has provided great utility for individuals in their daily life, it is important to acknowledge the ethical and authentic concerns in utilizing these tools to ensure integrity. The following ethical and authentic considerations should be considered whenever using AI tools or even navigating the internet. Although it is nearly impossible to avoid data collection altogether today, we are able to acknowledge when AI is operating and make decisions accordingly. Here are some suggestions to consider when utilizing artificial intelligence. Are there any questions?
Good job. That was very informative. Thank you. Anyone have any questions? Well, everyone's really quiet. All right, well, then we have our next person on our list then. We have Michael, advanced Googling. He's not here. He's not here.
I'm here.
Oh, yeah, Michael's here. Okay, your turn, Michael.
I've got to make this a quick second because I'm at work right now, but I'll do the best I can to give you all some good information.
Okay, do you want me to come back to you then?
No, it's it'll be fine. Let me just get this see if I can get this going. Entire screen. Okay. Can y'all see my PowerPoint?
Yes.
Awesome. Okay. So advanced Google hacking techniques. That's absurd. So advanced Google hack techniques is used for can be used for penetration testing, you know, conducting offensive attacks on another company. You can also use it for schooling also. So whether it's used for hacking or research just depends on what you're trying to do. So for this perspective, while I'm studying my certified ethical hacker, we're going to look at this from the perspective of black box testing, gray box testing, and white box testing. So white box testing. Reconnaissance really isn't needed for it. Hackers will have information, will have access to all the infrastructure information up front, and it really imitates the an insider threat. The only time reconnaissance might be used for white box texting is if you're trying to, basically if you're trying to find maybe a social media account, some emails, something where you can reach out and conduct phishing attacks. Over here we have gray box texting. So reconnaissance may be used. It's much more realistic as opposed to white box testing, and it's referred to as partial knowledge. So again, maybe you're going to use some Google hacking techniques for finding social media accounts, emails, the operating system of the operating system the company is using for their websites or applications. and we have black box testing. Reconnaissance 100% necessary. The attackers are going to this test completely blind, and it's also referred to as a zero knowledge test. So we don't, maybe you might not know the URL of the website, you might not know the operating system used, the name of the company, etc. So we're going to use reconnaissance planning when it comes to, we're going to use reconnaissance planning for the planning phase of it. So you're going to use this to gather information regarding the target. So, for example, maybe I want to attack my Facebook account. I can go in there and I can conduct reconnaissance on it. I can try and find their email address, where they live, maybe secure the information about them and such. So one of the different commands is called intitle. So if you type in intitle colon, then you have logonsite.eccouncil.com. So that's going to require that information to be listed in the search after hitting enter. Over here, we have specific words, file type, colon, PDF. So if I want to find someone's Facebook account, I can type in Michael Vitale, space, Facebook, space, file type, colon, PDF, or Word, or text, or whichever. And all of the search results will pull up with that exact information. Now we have cache, colon, www.xyzwebsite.com. So Google occasionally will cache a website that you created. So if I type in cache, colon, www.facebook.com or google.com or msn.com, you're going to see a previous version of that website that Google saved maybe days, weeks, months, years ago, et cetera. Now, the copy isn't working, but there might be some information that's relevant when conducting the attack. Now, all in URL. So all in URL, colon, and then you're going to type in keywords again. This is going to require those keywords to be inside the URL of which you're searching. So if you're trying to find extra websites or you're trying to find a specific username, so a lot of time with, say, Facebook, when you go into facebook.com, your name is often going to be in that URL. So you can use that to search for other people's social media accounts also. Now, in anchor. So in anchor is basically going to require you to have access to a link. So if I type in anchor colon Norton or Facebook, Norton or Facebook will be inside of that link. Next we have link colon www.xyz.com. So this is going to require that website to be part of the link. So facebook.com will be in the link, EC Council, etc. So now I'm going to go in, we're going to actually do some of these tests. So if I go over here, I'm on google.com and I have my information tabbed out. So if I say I want to go over to facebook.com and try and find a PDF. So I have Facebook space file type colon PDF. So everything that I put in here, it's going to open up a PDF. So let's see. Let me get this going again. Oops. All right. Give me one second. It looks like my information got a little bit messed up in there.
It happens sometimes.
Let's see if we got anything in here. All right, we'll move on to the next one since I made a mistake on that. Sorry about that. All right, so we'll go to intitle. Here, see, add intitle. We did facebook.com. We're seeing every single thing in here is going to have facebook.com that we're searching for. Now we'll go into a little more information. So say I want to go into login and passwords. We can get in here too, and we can hit F12 on this, and we can look at some of the code that's involved. So we have access to the code of many different websites that we can find a lot more easily. And then maybe we want to conduct attack, maybe something relevant to, say, social engineering. I can go in here and I hit inspect element, then we can see what's in here. Let me see if I can find a good example. So maybe you're trying to, attack someone's social media account. So if I can type in, if I convince them to say, hey, I got into your account by doing stuff like this, I can change the wording in it. So send them a screenshot of that. It might make them a little bit uncomfortable. So there's some social engineering aspects to it. Let's go to the next one. So we have colon URL. This happened to me last time too. I did this. So again, it requires that Facebook will be inside the URL or whichever other information. So Facebook and career. Or maybe I just want to type in Google. Now Google is going to be in every single URL that we're looking for. All right. So aside from that, that concludes my presentation. Does anybody have any questions?
Nope. Well done, man.
Good job on that.
Okay, thank you.
I was like, yeah, I should have been taking notes, but I haven't. I didn't do that. We can watch it again another time. But thank you so much, Michael.
Oh, you're
appreciate
welcome.
It.
Thank you.
All right. Our next speaker we have is Hesu. About the positive impact of AI on the tech field. Are you ready?
Yeah, so you can mic up.
Hey, Sue. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, sorry.
Looks like something's trying to come up.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you, but I don't.
Of AI and tech field.
We don't see the slides. You might want to try it again.
Yeah, sorry about that. I'm not even sure what's going on. This has been weird all day.
Huh. I'm not sure.
I'm not even sure. Okay, so the positive impact of AI in the tech is revolutionizing technology. First, the introduction, I think, basically the overview is like, of human intelligence and machines basically go from machine work, neural network, many other things. AI in modern development, tech development is efficiency, transforming industries, and so on. Enhancing efficiency. AI basically kind of works as a it can automate tasks for humans, like sending emails, adding things, you know, when you're buying things on websites, ads and takes out, like there's many things it can do that frees up the human time, so it's like you don't have to worry about those things anymore. It go from robots in assembly lines, you know, customer service, automated data entry, and so on. improving user experience. Obviously, it tailors to products. Like if you're on a website, it will probably generate ads and things that are tailored more to what you're looking for. Basically, personalized content, adaptive user interface in mobile apps, and voice assistants, hands-free interaction, enabling data-driven decisions. This basically helps business make informed decisions, predictive maintenance in manufacturing, fraud detection, target marketing campaigns based on consumers' data, complex issues. So basically AI helps tackle issues that we never knew were even there. I know I use this a lot, kind of going back to, I forget his name. He basically talked about like tricks to use ChatGPT or any other kind of AI to help you code. I kind of do the same. I use it like if I can't figure out why something's not working, I'll ask ChatGPT, why is this not working or something. It helps complex challenges. AI helps pretty much address things that you didn't know were there. Helps create jobs and opportunities. AI basically boosts creation in the tech field, in related tech field, researcher engines, AI trainers, and educators. Basically, overview is AI has revolutionized the tech field in numerous positive ways, efficiency, productivity, and accuracy across all industries. Here are just some examples: automation, data and analysis, personalization, and predictive capabilities. That's basically it.
Thanks. Appreciate that. All right. Anybody have questions for Jesus?
None here.
All right. Everyone seems quiet, so that's good. Okay. And our next presenter, he's not here, but I have the recording. Okay. So one moment while it gets set up. All right, let me know if you can hear it.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining me today. My name is Sal Robaba, and as both a cybersecurity major and avid gamer, I'm particularly excited to share some insights about cybersecurity in the gaming industry. So the gaming industry has experienced exponential growth over the past decade, really transforming into a digital powerhouse that captures the attention of billions worldwide.
Hey, Charlene, there's a pretty bad echo.
With immense growth, of course, comes significant challenges. All right, so let's grab...
Sorry about that, Dan. It's my fault. So let me mute my mic and then get this again started.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining me today. My name is Sal Robaba, and as both a cybersecurity major and avid gamer, I'm particularly excited to share some insights about cybersecurity in the gaming industry. So the gaming industry has experienced exponential growth over the past decade, really transforming into a digital powerhouse that captures the attention of billions worldwide. However, with this immense growth, of course, comes significant challenges. All right, so let's grasp the sheer magnitude and economic impact of this sector. In 2023, the global games market reached a whopping $184 billion in revenue. So this shows not only its entertainment value, but its significant economic footprint too. Projections suggest that by 2026, this number is expected to reach over $205 billion. To put this into perspective, the film industry was worth about $42.5 billion in 2023. And as of last year, there are over 3 billion gamers worldwide. About 55% are male and 45% are female. So with 1.7 billion male gamers and 1.3 billion female gamers, there are tons of opportunities for cyber criminals here. Not only does this sector generate billions of dollars, there is a treasure trove of personal information to be had from the 3 billion gamers across the globe. Furthermore, the high profile nature of the industry adds to the appeal. You'll have some hackers that just want to get their name out there. They just want the notoriety. Also, the attack surface being so vast and varied only makes things worse and adds to the issues. But aside from personal gain, some bad actors may target game studios or publishers in order to make a political statement. Although this is less common, but you know, we do sometimes see, you know, hacktivists in the gaming industry. But most attacks involve the theft of customer and corporate data through data breaches, and nowadays a lot of ransomware attacks. Now let's get into some notable cases. Some of you may have heard of Bandai Namco. They are a Japanese game publisher. They're most known for owning the licenses for games like Pac-Man, Galaga, Tekken, Dark Souls, and Elden Ring. They suffered from a few problems back in 2022. So their systems were compromised by a ransomware group, and customer information was stolen along with some corporate data. Also in 2022, in an unrelated event, Bandai Namco was forced to take the PC servers offline for the entire Dark Souls trilogy. So in all three games, there was a vulnerability in the actual code of the games that, when exploited, would allow an attacker to actually execute code on the victim's machine. This is what's called an RCE, or remote code execution exploit. So the consequences of that can be pretty severe. An attacker could potentially take control of your PC. They could steal data from it, or if they were feeling, you know, really evil, they could brick it and make it completely useless. I actually used to play the Souls games on PC, and when all of this happened, when I found out, I switched to my PlayStation 5 to play these games. Luckily, nothing ever happened to me, but you know, it was pretty scary learning about the RCE exploit after it had been discovered, because you know, I had been playing these games online on PC, totally unaware of the fact that I could have become a victim at any point. I got lucky. Bandai Namco worked with the developer of these games, From Software, and eventually patched the exploit, and they put the servers back online, but it took months. CD Projekt Red, they're a Polish game studio famous for developing The Witcher 3 and Cyberpunk 2077. In 2021, they suffered from a ransomware attack, and that actually resulted in the theft of the source code for Cyberpunk 2077
and an unreleased version of The Witcher 3. Now, something like that would go for a lot of money. You know, people would be interested in seeing the source code for, you know, big famous games like that. So the attackers demanded a ransom, of course, but CD Projekt Red refused to pay it. So what the hackers did was they leaked some of the data online to try and get CD Projekt Red to pay the ransom. They still refused. So they ended up starting an auction on a hacking forum for the data. And the starting bid was $1 million. And they also had like a almost like a twisted version of an eBay buy it now price for $7 million. They ended up taking down the auction because they received a private offer. And as a result of that whole attack, CD Projekt Red totally revamped their entire IT infrastructure and beefed up their security. And this was a big one. In 2011, Sony's PlayStation Network was breached. The servers were down for about 3 weeks, actually a little over 3 weeks. I think it was 24 days because of the attack. And this meant if you had a PlayStation, you couldn't play online. You couldn't use any of the online services. And what's worse, actually, is 77 million accounts ended up being compromised, including mine, you know, which is nice. I actually had to change, you know, my password and get a new credit card because payment info was also compromised. So if you had a credit card linked to your account, that would have been compromised. So I had to, you know, change all my passwords, get a new credit card. So that was a pain, and I wasn't the only one. Of course, there were 77 million other people that had the same issue. So naturally, Sony faced huge lawsuits for this, and they had to compensate their users. So we all got 30 days of free PlayStation Plus membership and 2 free games. And total, this whole incident cost Sony about $171 million. So what can we do to improve security in this space? Because we've seen how disastrous it can be when security is breached, whether it's for a publisher or a studio themselves, or even insecurities within the game code, like with the Dark Souls games and that RCE exploit. We've seen how dangerous these things can be. So for starters, game developers need to understand the importance of cybersecurity in their software. Security should be built into the entire development process. Data should be collected and monitored for security issues. Infrastructure should use the principle of least privilege to limit the damage that can be done in the event of a breach. I mean, because let's be real, it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. And user information should be encrypted and stored securely. Endpoint protection needs to be put in place. Pen tests and red teaming is always a good option to find vulnerabilities. And last but not least, I think it's important for, you know, these game studios and these publishers to educate not only their employees, but also their users, the gamers themselves. They need to educate gamers about phishing attacks and other social engineering tactics to prevent these kinds of things from occurring. So the key takeaways are: the gaming industry makes more money than most other entertainment sectors, with a projected market value of $200 billion. Its rapid growth and large population of users makes it a very, very attractive target for cyber criminals. And we've seen real-world examples of how devastating security breaches can be in this industry, affecting millions of users worldwide. And it's not something that, you know, you just hear about. Like, I can relate to this. It's happened to me. And lastly, from initial game design to post-launch support, I believe strongly that security should be built into the entire game development process. Thank you all very much for listening. Have a great night.
Okay. Did you all see the references at the end? Okay. Well, I know he's not here to answer any questions, but I have one more to show you. And this is from Jose Barrios Medina about nanobots. Can you see my screen? Oh. Sorry, I have to mute my mic. Let me know if you cannot hear. Oh, I'm trying to get some for you.
Greetings. My name is Jose Miguel Ber- Greetings, my name is Jose Miguel Berrios Medina, and I'll be presenting on nanobots. Next slide. Before going into details on what nanobots are and what they are used for, I will be explaining what the concept of nanotechnology is as a whole. Nanotechnology is a field of study and practice that focuses on using nano-sized material to manipulate it so it can be used in different sectors such as medical, production, energy, and manufacturing. Nanotechnology was first mentioned in Tokyo in 1974 by N. Taniguchi at the International Conference of Industrial Production. Next slide. Now to give an explanation on what nanotechnology themselves are. Nanorobots is a field inside the nanotechnology group that focuses on small robots that are able to create skyscrapers and fight malicious disease in human bodies. The idea of using nanorobots for such issues arose in 1988 when nanotechnologist Eric Drexler wrote an article on how the mix of using robots and nanotechnology could solve specific problems. Now that nanorobots are created to help individuals in the nanoscale, it is important to understand that the main issue with these types of robots is that to be able and create them, specific tools need to be developed and used. Industrial equipment would not work because they are not specifically designed to work with nanoscale. Another issue was that at the time, of Eric Drexler's article, specific equipment was not yet created that would be able and properly design the nanorobots. Yet 30 years later, we have seen a vast amount of advances that would be key to the success of nanorobots. Next slide. Humans think that nanorobots are devices that are microscopical tools that we can use that are made of metallic material, but that is not the case. The actual understanding of nanorobots are cells and tissues in our bodies that we manipulate in a way that they could work for us to do a specific task. To show what the scale of what nanorobots actually looks like, I researched a nanorobot called Xenobot that is created by using 500 to 1,000 living cells. The size of this is 1 millimeter, which is bigger than the nanoscale, but can still be used for medical research. As shown in this screen, the size that is seen is fairly big compared to the nanoscale, and yet it's still very small. In research, the comparison of the Earth next to the marble is an example to explain how small the nanoscale actually is. Here in the screen, we can show that 1 millimeter in the bottom right is equal to the top right, which is the Xenobot. Another important tool for diagnostic related to nanotechnologies are nanodiagnostic tools, which are specifically tools that measure between 1 and 100 nanometers and are used to properly diagnose problems in humans. These tools are used by specific pills, electrical, or liquid devices that are used to verify, biopsy, and human senses to properly diagnose them. Next slide. As heard earlier, nanotechnology is an advancement that can help in so many different ways, including technical fields. Healthcare is one of the most important because we see that it is so hard to do surgeries without causing problems when exposing to the outside world. Some nanobots technologies have already been created to be able and transport medication to specific parts of the body while being controlled with magnets from the outside. There are also some nanotechnologies that use specific body parts to help in combating the illnesses, to help find specific problems with humans before any machine could. Other fields in which nanotechnology would work are in the engineering, as mentioned before, where nanotechnology would be able to be used in cases of building and repairing boards and electrical devices that need precise measurements and solutions. Next slides. Like most fields, when new technology emerges, some problems come with it. Some of the major issues with nanotechnologies are if the use of particles in the body and the way that they help humans needs to be correctly regulated so that if issues do arise, proper measures are in place to help combat them. Funding and resources is also an issue because equipments are not made to work with small materials as in the nanoscale, making it hard to find funding for this type of research and for even trying to properly develop it. It is also hard to develop a way to properly control this type of material and to give it directional instructions. In conclusion, nanotechnology is a field in which we have yet found the plausible answer to issues that have emerged from them. But the development of this technology has been in constant growth since its mention in 1974. Lastly, nanotechnology, next slide, nanotechnology, the future. We have already mentioned in what type of applications nanorobots have been used in, but with the technology emerging, it is expected that we will be able to use it in environmental cleanup, like oil spills, in space exploration, because we can use the nanotechnology to be able to fix any space exploration issues that emerges, enhancing manufacturing to make better boards and better technology, smaller and easier to handle and carry, and medical treatment to be able to biopsy and five different issues with humans beings. That is all. Thank you for your time. I put the reference, and at the end, I was able to actually find a nanorobot surgeon video that will help individuals understand how these nanotechnologies actually work and how they are used. Thank you for your time, and I'll put play to the video now.
This is a little bit, we are starting from a little bit bigger size as an example.
Okay.
So this is a swallowable capsule robot, which has a camera on board, wireless communication, and it has...
It has a camera, you say?
Yes. There's a very tiny camera, the black part. So this, and you see LED
lights.
Where
is the camera?
It's at the end here.
Okay.
And then there are small magnets inside. As you mentioned, to manipulate anything, you need some physical force. In this case, this capsule has magnets inside, and another external magnet can exert force on this capsule, and inside your body, this can be navigated. So it can roll inside your stomach, it can be stopped, it can go backward and forward really? As a robot.
Well, how would you put it in you?
So you swallow it. So it's a pill size.
You swallow it?
So yeah, this is... completely wireless robot, as you see in the video. Also, it's made out of a soft material so that it can deform, and it's very safe to use. As you mentioned, safety is our first rule about the design. And by rolling inside your stomach's tissue surface, the doctor can stop it. And then by controlling the external force, you can indeed eject a drug. Here you see this blue thing.
Oh, is wow. It's still in middle period.
Exactly. And it can do this many times. And it can actively image your body so that you can see where you want exactly.
Do it again. Let's see what's it again. But first of all, who is running? It looks like it's got a will. Like, is it being driven by something?
You see that there's an external magnet that the doctor has full control of. And indeed, it's moving outside. Like you use a magnet outside your body, and it's moving the robot inside your body.
Oh, so there's a doctor outside of you with a magnet, and then there's this little thing wobbling. And so the doctor is moving it.
Exactly. That's why it's safe, so that you don't have any, you know, decision.
Is the doctor squeezing out that blue juice?
Yeah. So doctor says that area has a disease, so that he or she decides to eject the drug at that point. And also the same robot can do biopsy, so it can cut something.
Whoa, wait a second. It's a 3-in-1. It can take pictures. It can leak, or whatever that is, pour. And it can cut?
Yes.
With what? What is it cutting with?
So the biopsy is a common procedure in GI tract that you want a small piece of your tissue to decide if there's a disease or not. Because sometimes camera images are not sufficient or wouldn't tell you the level of the disease. So doctor needs to take a piece of your tissue and do analysis afterwards. So that we need to pick up this capsule later and do some analysis, which is a little bit dirty.
But wait a second, does it like have a knife in its pocket, or like where is the cutting thing?
It's inside the middle. So it's very safely located, so it doesn't cause any damage. Uh-huh. But as in the drug releasing case, when a doctor controls the force and presses this thing on purpose, the knife comes out and gets a small.
It's like a switchblade.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Whoa. And so you can then take a little bit of something and then bring it to the doctor.
Exactly.
How do you, I'm assuming that you bring it to the doctor in the old fashioned way.
in the biopsy case, yes, you need to pick it up coming out of natural ways. But other cases, we don't pick
that's
it up.
That's the intern does that? Or who?
That's the cost of high technology.
I see.
Okay, did you guys hear all that?
Yep.
Yes, we did.
Okay, good. Because I wasn't sure, and I experimented the other day, made my own team meeting and see if it works, but I'm only on one side of the thing, so I didn't have anybody witnessing if it was working or not. Okay. All right. Any comments? I'm sorry, I can't answer any questions because these are not my research. But that was very interesting, though, about the thing in the stomach and what they can do with nanotechnology. But I don't trust it yet. Too new. But that's my comment. All right. And I think that's all we have for today. Not unless anyone wants to do a presentation that they have next week or another week. You can if you're able to. No? All right, then I guess we're done with our meeting. I'll go ahead and end the recording.